Aldo, welcome into the Poets Cove.
Thank you so much, Daniel. Thank you so much for having me here.
And we invited a couple of writers into the Cove, as always. That's kind of playing with this format. We have Candace. Candace Duran, and she's a fiction writer and a poet, right, Candace? And she's read your book.
Yes.
And then we have Kalina Gallardo, and you know her already, Aldo. She's also an amazing writer. So welcome to the Cove, Aldo. And let's talk a little bit about, when I say you hit the lottery, I mean, you really hit it with this first book. This is an amazing book. It's getting a lot of attention that it deeply deserves. One of the things I love to do about poetry, I'm not a poet myself, at least not in the conventional sense that I write verse, is I love swimming in poetry. I mean, swimming to where I feel my whole body moving, and I just go up and down and follow the language, and I feel like I could swim in this book for a very long time.
Thank you so much. That's beautiful.
And you know what, Aldo? When I knew you as a student, you read a poem to me one time, and I thought, whoa, that's stunning. You were my TA, and one time you were editing a poem that you were doing in Pimentel's class, I believe, and you showed it to, or you read it to me. I go, oh my God, this guy's good. So let me ask you, first of all, how did it feel? Where were you when you found out you won the prize? What were you doing, and how did it feel?
So I was here in my room, and I got a call. It was from Joseph Fasano, the poet. And I got really excited, and at first I thought maybe I didn't win, but maybe they wanted to say, because at first the year before I was finalist. So I thought that maybe that is the 2020 award hat. I already had been finalist or something like that. And then they told me that I won, and I was so excited.
And what did you do? Did you go celebrate, or put on headphones and listen to music? What did you do?
I did went to celebrate that night with some friends.
Okay.
Just super excited. I called them, gave them the news.
Wow. That's awesome. How long did it take you to put this book together? Brother Sleep, it's called. How long did it take you to get this book together?
So I started putting it together as a manuscript. I would like to say maybe the last year of the MFA, because at first I went in as a fiction writer.
You did? I didn't know that.
Yes. So my original thesis was going to be a collection of short stories, which I was working with an Alex to my committee chair. And something about it was, and especially it was Ocean Wong's Night Sky with Exit Wounds that really made me pursue poetry.
And did you write it when you were in a particular class? And is that why you wrote it?
Some poems, yes. Some poems I wrote in Sasha Pimentel's class, in Andrea Gotero's class, in Rosa Galas' class. I always like to say that one of the, probably the earliest poem in the book that I wrote was Primer for a View of the Sea. Mm-hmm. That sequence poem, I wrote it when I was an undergrad. And when I was putting together my thesis, I was looking through old poems and I was like, oh, this is horrible. This is horrible.
Right.
Oh, I can do something with this. And yeah, that was kind of the origin of the book.
Wow. Can we talk a little bit about how Brother Sleep took its shape? There seems to be this kind of brother that his spirit and presence is occupies a lot of occupies actually a bad word, whose spirit comes out in a lot of these poems. Can you talk about this, how this brother became part of this, the glue that held it together?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are different parts where I came with this concept. The most personal, because I'm an only child, so I didn't have a brother. But because of this, when I was a kid, I also have a single mom, mm-hmm. and she worked a lot, so I was on my own a lot, and I always felt this need to form bonds with other people. And because I always wanted to have a brother, I always befriended, like became like best friends with someone and asked, do you want to be my brother?
That's great.
Yes. And when I was in high school, in a certain year, I lost my grandfather, and I lost one of those friends that had become like a brother to me. And because of this, my grief extended for a long, long period of time. Wow. And I always kept trying to hide it, to be strong and to not show it to my family. And the way I navigated this grief and this period of my life, which was also the period where I was trying to come out of the closet, but I had all these insecurities about perception and masculinity and all that. And all that period is what propelled the original idea for this.
Wow. You know, I imagine a lot of people ask you about your brother after reading this book, believing the brother to be real, which is a compliment, because there really is a presence of that brother throughout the pages, where I can feel his spirit. I can feel his ghost. And so I'm convinced that he exists. And I'm wondering if, because I'm able to imagine the brother, I imagine you're imagining of the brother that oftentimes took on visual representations, and I'm wondering if these visual representations of a brother, you were a kid growing up wanting a brother, if they might have started with childhood. Did you picture the brother you wanted when you were a kid, and how has that image transformed over the years?
I don't know if I imagined a brother, but I always became really close with friends. And I always wanted a brotherly figure in them.
I see.
Yeah,
I'm fishing in the wrong pond then. That makes a lot of sense. So let's fast forward to when you lost the friend who was like a brother. Do you find that your images of him, your memories, your, maybe feelings associated with him are dominating the image that we get as readers of the brother, that he influenced it more maybe than anybody else?
I believe so. But I also wanted the figure of the brother in the book to be different concepts as well. Okay. So, for example, in one poem, I'm calling my brother in the brown box die for loving and so on and so forth. And I'm picturing more than one brotherly figure in the poems. And then I also take the concept of sleep and his brother death from the Greek myth. Right.
I was just gonna say, let's talk a little bit about sleep. I don't know quite how to ask this question, and it might be a really stupid question, and if it is, that's okay, because we have to allow ourselves to be stupid. But I'm wondering if you have, because there's sleep you know, involved in this, and there's death and there's pain. And a lot of times when somebody is depressed, they just want to sleep all the time. That, you know, and one of the reasons why I think that they want that, not to suggest that you were depressed at all. That's not even where I'm going, so don't worry about that. But I'm wondering if you have experienced, or how you've experienced, the hypnagogic state where you're between sleep and awake, and those images just kind of come to you involuntarily. And if that's an experience that you've allowed to influence the way you write or the images that you come up with.
Definitely. Yes, I did struggle with depression after that period for a while. And what I found is that I wasn't so much always wanting to sleep, but I did suffer a lot from insomnia. So I would wake up in the middle of the night with anxiety and couldn't fall back to sleep.
Tormented by your thoughts.
But in that state, sometimes that happened, the images. Right. And I always tell my students when I teach imagery and poetry that dream images are so important to bring out the strangeness in poetry and bring out the uniqueness and the freshness.
You are listening to A Conversation in the Writer's Cove. If you want to hear the extended version of this, you can go to wordsonawire.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Now let's get back to the conversation. So here is the line. It says, blue, and it goes, blue like Marcello's lungs spraying the floor. Oh my God, that's just such a powerful image. And it haunted me. And you have these images like that that aren't what you would normally see in the waking state, but like images that you need to travel. You know, some might call it the astral plane, some might call it the hypnagogic state. But you seem to have access to this dream imagery that normal people don't have access to. How do you get there? I'm wondering how do you get there, and how do you trust it and say, oh no, that's stupid, that doesn't make sense.
Thank you so much for those comments. I want to say that from my own dreams, my own dreaming, but also from film. So movies became, when I was younger, one of those escapes from the loneliness and all of that. And I always loved unusual imagery in movies. Up to this date, I'm always like super into surreal cinema and all that.
Wow. Like what? Give us an example.
One of my favorite movies is Schenectady, New York.
What is it called?
Schenectady, New York.
Schenectady.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was trying to form a meaningful word with what you were saying. I couldn't picture Schenectady. Oh, wow. And why?
So it's Schenectady, as in the city Schenectady, but it is also Schenectady, like the literary technique of representing the part with the whole with the part.
Oh, I don't know that term. I suppose I should, as a professor of creative writing. And so does that theme fit in with the images and the narrative through line, whatever it may be?
So this movie is deals a lot with mortality, and I used one of the lines in that movie as the title of the last poem in the book.
Wow! Really? Can I read that line?
Yeah, of course. Like,
burying into each other's breath, which is to say,
I know it's the title.
Oh, the title.
This room will still exist.
Oh, I love that title too. That is one of my, that's awesome. You know, when I came out with my novel, my very first novel years ago, when you were not even born, I didn't know what I was going to call it. And I was watching this movie about this guy who was this famous cellist in, you know, 19th century France or something like that. I think it was with Gérard Depardieu. But the line was, somebody was telling about this image of this person and says, and then the shadows took him. And I go, that's it. And the shadows took him. Although I didn't really like the movie, I like that line, so I could totally understand that. But I'm going to have to watch that. You know, my problem with movies is I want movies to be entertainment, and I haven't quite developed the sophistication of watching movies for art's sake, which is something I need to overcome because I know there's a lot of beautiful, beautiful works out there. So a lot of how you. You have what Lorca calls the poetic logic, right? Or the poetic imagination where you can access images like that, not have to beat the crap out of them and to get some sort of meaning out of them. Is this how you think? Is this how a poet thinks? Like when you walk from one building to another on campus where you're going to teach a class, do you allow yourself to interact with weird images? Or I don't know. I want to know what it's like to be you.
Sometimes, yeah. And I also use a lot of everyday imagery mixed in with that, sort of to ground the poem, the reader. Mm-hmm. So I guess it deals both ways. Like I take everyday imagery into my poetry, and I take dream imagery into my life.
Wow. You're like a mystic. Seriously, that's what mystics do. If you look at the archetypal mystic, Swedenborg, he would walk around without having slept for 3 days. He'd walk around the streets of London and he would hallucinate and really thought they were angels and wrote, you know, thousands of pages on his experience. I think that's beautiful. I'm trying to be able to more access that space. And one of the things that I'm doing is I used to write in the morning, but what I'm realizing now about myself that took me, you know, this long to realize is that in the morning I'm logical and I'm structured. So now I'm writing at night and those dream images come into my work and it's just enriching it so much. When do you write? What time of day?
This time around I'm writing more in the morning. But when I wrote this book, I wrote at night, late at night.
Oh. Like, can you tell us a little bit about your writing process?
There's a lot of reading involved.
Let's double click on that. What do you mean?
So whenever I want to write a poem, I try to keep books of poetry of the poets that I admire most near me, so Ooh. I can access some sort of inspiration. I think that's important to have your literary mentors by your side.
Right. I love that image. I could see it. What popped into my mind is Aldo right there with all these great poets, the spirits of great poets surrounding yes. him. Yeah, that's awesome. And so who is in your, I don't want to say pantheon, but whose spirits are surrounding you? You know, whose poetry is surrounding you that you could just reach and grab and open?
Definitely Lorca, Ocean Vuong, definitely.
Have you met him yet? You've met him, right?
Not in person.
Not in person.
I was present with the in the Words on a Wire interview with him.
Oh, you were in that interview. Okay, all right, cool. That was a long time ago. Because you were a graduate student back then. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have Ocean Vuong, you have Lorca. Who else is surrounding you?
Natalie Diaz.
Oh my God! Yeah, she's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, she can. Oh. She can transform. She can transform me. Yeah, absolutely. Who else?
Let's see.
Well, you know, it's interesting that everybody that you've mentioned, except for one, is a living young poet. And I think that's what makes your poetry, one of the reasons your poetry is so fresh, because you're reading young, brilliant poets and not just the dead poets. One of the lamentations I have about creative writing some of my students in creative writing undergraduate classes. Brilliant people. I mean, there's no question about it. But when I, every class I've ever had, I've always asked them to name a poet at the beginning of the class. And most of them couldn't name a poet, which is weird. Whereas if you, I asked that, you would say Natalie Diaz, Ocean Vuong, these just incredible poets that are putting out, you know, really changing, influencing poetry today.
Yes.
How does it feel to be a part of that? Oh, I'm sorry. What were you going to say?
And I also try to have as much living, working poets right now in my syllabus when I'm teaching.
Absolutely. How does it feel now to be among them? Because you are, this is your first book. You are really at the level now of Natalie Diaz and Ocean Vuong, just starting out. How does it feel to be a part of that community?
I don't know. I guess I find it hard to feel that way.
Good.
yeah. I guess it's my little imposter syndrome working. But yeah, I still can't imagine myself in those places.
Yeah. Let's go down that path a little bit further when it comes to imposter syndrome. And this is something that I know as a Chicanx writer and one who was, like, my first job as a professor, the first day security followed me from my car to the building because I was parking in the faculty lounge, in the faculty parking. And, you know, these kind of things are things that we've had over and over before. And you, as a Latinx growing up on the border, your sexual orientation is very hard for you to struggle with when you were a kid. You have this poem in this book about these school kids picking on the speaker of the poem and calling him, what was that word that they call him for gay? I forget. I'd never heard of that word in that context.
Is it the puñal?
Puñal, yes, yes. What was the word they were calling him?
It would be a derogatory term in Spanish, but it has two meanings. So it would mean like a knife or a dagger.
Right.
And then it would be a slur for gay men.
Right, right. But you know, all these upbringings that we have that continually knock us down, you know, we as Latinx people, as people oppressed, as women, began to develop what Lorna D. Cervantes calls the nagging feeling that I'm not good enough. And so when we become as successful as you are, we do feel like maybe I faked my way in here. You know, maybe I'm not smart enough. Maybe I'm really not good enough. And I know right now, although that never goes away, I have it now. And I'm 60 years old and I've been in this business for a long time. It never goes away, but it's your strength. I was hoping that you would be able to read us one of the poems from the book. I'd love to hear you read, because when I read it in my voice, and I've read it to my students in my senior seminar, when I read it in my voice, it just sounds so beautiful. But that's probably my ego talking, because the poems are beautiful. So I'd love to hear you read it. I'd like to know what it sounds like, because your poems sound really cool. Would you read one?
Of course. Is there any particular one that...
The one that you read the best or that you like reading the most, unless anybody else has a request.
I would love to hear a reading of Thanatophobia or Sleep Addresses His Brother, if you don't mind.
Oh, that is a good one. That is a good one. That's, yeah, absolutely. Is that okay, Aldo?
Of course.
What page is it on for those who are following in the Missalette? You could tell I was a Catholic kid, you know, page 46 on the Missalette, and I'm still doing that exegesis of beautiful texts. What page is it on?
Page 15.
Anatophobia, or Sleep Addresses His Brother. And this has an epigraph by Federico García Lorca, which reads, "No duerme nadie por el mundo." Night, the world boils. Men toss sleepless in their sheets like stars, because I look down where a man holds his only son among the spillage of buildings and children sitting on the debris after the bombs cast their shadows onto stone. There the boy hangs from his father's arm, his father's hand folded to the open neck, and the open eyes like cold nickels look past me, past the white sheet of linen. How terrible the fabric that veils the end. How terrible the night for him, the sleepless brother. When an American soldier swallows a grenade which bursts as it slips down his throat, a Mexican immigrant, a woman beaten half to death for stealing a pomegranate, breaks the fruit skin open, red from her wounds like the inside of the fruit or the inside of the soldier. And doctors put to sleep a girl to replace her heart with a new beating. Soon that artificial sleep turns the same terrible fabric. Her mother, quiet as a desert in the hall, admires Wojnarowicz's untitled Buffalo, that great beast at the edge of the photograph, suspended in air forever. And the girl's father reaches her mother's arms to keep her from plunging off the rooftop to fall into you, brother. I know nothing but impermanent rest. How do you do it? Each time you take and wrap your permanence around sleep. Brother, you terrify me. You make my heart gallop like buffaloes in the white desert, their large bodies advancing their fall.